Tickets are now available for I Am The Egg Pod Live, taking place at 3 p.m. on Saturday the 1st of July at the beautiful Opera Holland Park in London. If you love the Beatles, then this is for you. There'll be an afternoon of Beatles discussions, exploring their music, their impact on popular culture, and the stories behind these legendary songs. Plus, an ideal opportunity to meet fellow Egg Podders and Beatle fans. In part one, Samira Ahmed, Stuart McConey, and David Quantick, and they'll be sharing their thoughts and insight into the Beatles' music. Then, in part two, Mark Lewison, world-renowned Beatles historian and author of the definitive Beatles biography, Tune In, and he's going to share his unrivaled expertise on the Fab Four story. So if you want to join in the fun, then tickets are available by going to iamtheeggpod.com. Saturday, 1st of July, 2023, starting 3 p.m. at Opera Holland Park Theatre, London. Hopefully see you there. Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a joy to welcome musician and co-host of the Big Beatles Sort Out, Paul Abbott. Hello.
Hello, Chris. It's very lovely to be here, to be a dried flowerhead in the potpourri of Egg Pod. Or a piece of orange peel or something, I don't know.
Yeah, lovely. I do love your podcast. I have to say I disagree with almost everything your brother says, but it's very enjoyable listen.
Yes, it's an example of pure subjectivity on his part. As any ranking or like any decent ranking thing knows that it is about subjectivity and one person's opinion, and it is just a way into getting to chat about something you really, really love. And the fact that it's me and my brother means that I am less perhaps cautious than friends might be about telling him he's wrong. He's a little brother, you see. The dynamic remains all these years later.
To this day, yeah.
Yeah.
When did you first discover the Beatles?
Very young, I think. I was trying to reckon this out in my head, as I have many times, as to whether my mum, and it would have been my mum probably, would have sat me down and said, here's a thing that I've listened to in the past or what. But my memory is just really sort of finding them in the house in terms of, my parents had 4 or 5 LPs, so they definitely had Rubber Soul and Revolver and Abbey Road on record. Yeah, so that's the ones we had on record. And then we also had some tapes, you know, opaque 1970s cassettes of Pepper and the Hey Jude compilation.
Ah.
Which is because my parents for a while were stationed in Germany, so I think that's where they would have got that from, because they wouldn't have bought it in the UK. And was there anything? Hard Day's Night, they had that on tape as well. And I just remember at some point I was listening to that stuff. And also at some point I was watching The Complete Beatles on VHS.
Oh, yes.
Which I have done again this week in preparation for this, because that is actually a place where someone we'll be talking about is featured as a talking head on it. But they wouldn't have bought that VHS for anyone except me. So I must have been enough into it in the mid-80s for them to get that. And that was one of the first things that really, really... So I had a bit of the music and I had The Complete Beatles on VHS, and that was like one of my bedrock bits of Beatledom.
Liverpool, 200 miles to the northwest of London. Nothing much ever came from Liverpool but soccer teams and British comedians. The city droned on wearily in post-war Britain, a nation nostalgic for its triumphant past, threadbare and tired in its present. For a boy growing up in Liverpool, the future was no brighter than that which his father had faced, or his father's father. In 1956, in fact, there was little to suggest that out of this provincial seaport would come 4 young men and a musical revolution that would captivate and change the world.
Ringo, George, John.
I still love it. I think it's absolutely brilliant for a sort of 2-hour telling of the tale. It's not bad at all.
Well, there was so little else out there, wasn't there? I remember it was incredibly expensive at the time. I had a friend who got a copy. Yeah. But there was nothing there. And it did, as you say, it covers the whole story, meat and two veg version of the Beatles. But it's what you want to know as a kid. You just want to know the story.
Yeah. And at the time, I hadn't even seen things like Hard Day's Night. So when it had the footage of them from A Hard Day's Night, I thought that was just like news footage.
Okay.
Yeah. So, which is confusing because, of course, the bit with Ringo saying I'm a mocker is also a thing that happened in real life. But that is in a film. And so... stuff like that. So it's funny, but it puts it together in a really exciting way because it like opens with the most bleak opening about Liverpool. And it's the place I live now. It's like, why would you have wanted to move there? And you'd seen that bit of footage in the film, you know, with Malcolm McDowell, I think it is, isn't it? Doing the narration about how dismal Liverpool was until the Beatles turned up. But then it kicks into this live version of rock and roll music and the screams of the audience just overwhelm it. And it's like, this is the most exciting thing ever.
Yeah.
And it's just, and then it cuts to the studio version and the titles. It's like, right, I'm ready for this. Oh, this is ace.
It's, this beginning reminds me of the beginning of Yellow Submarine, the movie.
Yes.
It's the same sort of.
Oh, yeah, I suppose that might be a bit of a homage.
Homage, yes. And yeah, also you got that colour 1966 footage at the Budokan, which I remember thinking, wow. I'd seen photos of it, but at the time I had no idea there was footage.
Yes, their playing on that 1966 tour perhaps isn't as good as it could have been had they been A, bothered and B, rehearsed. But it still seems daft that they've got like these full-length colour films of those concerts and they haven't released them in some format for people to watch in decent quality. Because I bet they're sat in their vaults all cleaned up for use. So,
oh, yeah. Come on, Apple.
Yeah, nagging Apple to release things is something you could do till the end of time, really, isn't it?
It is. So tell me about the album we're talking about today.
Well, in terms of actually owning this album, I didn't own it in this format anyway until fairly recently. It's an album that a lot of people will have had sort of in tape and CD, not bootlegs, but like other versions of, you could buy sort of officially. And a lot of people know a couple of the tracks from the anthology as well. But this is, I don't know how to pronounce its full title. I suppose it'd be like The Beatles First, recorded in Hamburg, 1961, with Tony Sheridan and guests. My bonnet lies over the ocean. My bonnet lies over the sea.
You've got the UK version that was released in, I love this, it was released on the 4th of August 1967.
Yeah.
With a psychedelic sleeve designed by Canadian artist Barry Zaid. So this is technically their follow-up to Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. The fact that it comes out in 67, but it is like their earliest recordings from a totally different era, an era where psychedelia was barely a concept. And so they've got this artist in who does... I was looking at other work by Barry Zaid, and he sort of does that 60s psychedelic futuristic Art Nouveau sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I can't quite work out what the cover of this is. It's like sort of Wurlitz has exploded or something like that. And it sort of fits more into the Yellow Submarine pattern of things than it does dingy Hamburg clubs.
Yeah. So, yeah, as you say, it's The Beatles First, brackets, recorded in Hamburg, 1961, with Tony Sheridan in guests. And the album was originally released in Germany in April 64, but was available in the UK as an import. And, yeah, of the 12 songs on the album, it's only 8 actually feature the Beatles. So what do you think of this album overall?
It's a really interesting thing. It is a Beatles album, but it's obviously not part of the official canon because it's Polydor, not EMI, Apple, etc. It's good to have a collection of their stuff all in one place. It's weird that it's seeded through with the Tony Sheridan Beat Brothers tracks by other musicians, because nowhere on it does it say that the Beat Brothers is a collective sort of name rather than a specific for a group of people.
Yeah.
So it's he doesn't explain quite who these Beat Brothers are on his little write up on the back of it. And it's partly a good example of someone It would be unfair to say he's writing himself into the story, because he was clearly in the story, Tony Sheridan. A very, very important thing here. But, yeah, it's really weird to have these, like, bits where it's clearly Lennon, or, you know, bits where it's, like, we're great sort of Beatles beat music, and then what's this stuff here? This is another one. And this guy that sounds like a sort of mad Elvis on some of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird, yeah. But apparently, the reason it comes out in the UK in 1964, import-wise, is the Polydor was trying to prop up its market a bit by sort of bringing over loads of its European stuff at the time. So it was trying to get a bigger slice of the UK market by doing a big import thing. So presumably people would have seen this in 1964, not just 1967 when it comes out officially in the UK in psychedelic mode.
Yes. I mean, there's hundreds of variations of this.
Yeah.
To this day, they continue to come out. But I think the thing for me, that one of the highlights about this particular album is the liner notes on the back by Tony Sheridan, which gives a bit of a story. It's not technically 100% accurate, but it does. No. It's more of a vibe, I think.
Yeah, he's trying to remember the dim and distant past of between 5 and 6 years before. Depending on which recording session they're talking about. And he sort of mentions some of the things, like mentions Peter, he mentions Stu Sutcliffe and things like that, and sort of says there was 5 Beatles in the band. Well, not just recording, there isn't. You know, it is the Beatles nearly as the Beatles. And he doesn't sort of talk about the fact that Bert Kampfert was a huge name, this guy who produced this record. A huge, absolutely huge name. But he does have a bit of a sense of this idea of these clubs and the Beatles sort of coming and going and getting better as they go along. But he does make it sound quite a bit like they were his backing band, full stop.
Yeah. One of the paragraphs that I do quite like is probably the most accurate one in here, but he says, sometimes we went down to the British Seamen's Mission near the harbour. We could get almost English food there. And talking about food, another place we went to a lot was a typical German imbiss on the Grosse Freiheit called Harold's. The Beatles always ate cornflakes with milk. At one time, that seemed to be their only staple diet, and we all had tea. Hello, yep. Teetles.
Yes, hello Hugh, hi Teetles. Yeah, I like the idea, but I seem to remember eating a lot of cereal, whether I had to or not, as a teenager, and these are quite, you know, they're late teenagers at this point, but you know, if you can get hold of some cereal as a snack, that'll keep you going. Nice cup of tea.
Absolutely. So I think probably the best thing, I'll just do a quick timeline from 1961. So January, February, previous year, the Beatles had effectively been thrown out of Germany after it was discovered that George was underage, while Paul and Pete Best were deported for setting fire to condoms. Now they were back in Liverpool. Then manager Alan Williams had booked them gigs at the Aintree Institute, Latham Memorial Hall, Blair Hall and Grosvenor Ballroom. But he was keen to try and get them back to Hamburg. So he'd written to the owner of the Top Ten Club in Hamburg, Peter Eckhorn, to try and explain to the German consulate that the owner of the Kaiserkeller, Bruno Koschmider, was basically being a dickhead. Then in March, work permits now granted, Alan gets a contract for the Beatles to appear at the Top Ten Club. He was then dismayed to discover that Pete Best had also been speaking to Peter Eckhorn, and the booking had already been arranged. 20th of April, Alan, who was justifiably annoyed at how he'd been betrayed, quit as their Beatles manager, and he wrote this letter. Dear all, I am very distressed to hear that you are contemplating not paying my commission out of your pay, as was agreed in our contract for your engagement at the Top Ten Club. May I remind you, seeing you were all appearing to get more than a little swollen-headed, that you would not even have smelled Hamburg if I had not made the contracts. And by law, it is illegal for any person under contract to make a contract through the first contract. I would also point out that the only reason you were there is through work that I did. If you had tried yourselves to play at the Top Ten Club without a bona fide contract and working through a British government-approved agency, you would not be in Germany right now. You've got to say, it does have a point.
Yeah, I mean, Alan Williams is so important to getting them out there. I mean, physically getting them out there in the first place, the first time. But their relationship goes so... I mean, when I came to Liverpool in the mid-90s to go to university, I used to go to the Jacaranda a lot, which obviously has a very big part in their legacy, and Alan Williams's. But that was Alan Williams' legacy was sort of marked out by the fact that his portrait was hung upside down over the door of the ladies' loos.
Oh,
as a sort of yeah. Which is just, and thinking back to the Complete Beatles video, he's interviewed on that as well, talking about this period. And he does use that brilliant line when he's talking about saying he got a letter from Howie Casey and the seniors, or Denny and the seniors, saying, if you send that bum group, the Beatles, over here, you're going to spoil it for everyone. But he does send them, and he does get them back there, and he gets them going. Yeah. And without that, they, like, the Beatles story hinges on so many pivot points of, if that person had done this, or if they'd gone there, and all that sort of, and that's it. Alan Williams is a very big cog, a very big pivot point in their story.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, moving forward to mid-May 61, Stuart Sutcliffe has obviously quit the Beatles, and elsewhere, Bert Kampfert had signed Tony Sheridan to Polydor, and the Beatles were chosen to be his backing band for a recording session.
It's really interesting because of Tony Sheridan, who could have already been a star by this point, if he had bothered to do things like turn up when he was expected to turn up for his TV show appearances and things like that.
Yeah.
But he could also have been dead in a car crash if he had just... If I mean, his story's insane. Like, that he was on tour with Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran, and they basically said, oh, you can't come in the car with us back to London. And he's like, oh, you swines. And he sort of hangs around waiting to get back to London. But they, of course, come off the road, and Eddie Cochran dies. It's a bit like the Buddy Holly plane, you know, someone missing that. It's a horrible rock and roll story.
Yeah, it's astonishing. There's so much in the same way the Beatles story, isn't it? All this serendipity. It's the same thing with Tony Sheridan in a completely different. It was like he was destined not to be part of this.
Mm. Totally, and yeah, it's a funny guy, because by the time he gets to Germany, which becomes basically his home for the rest of his life, I think, he's already been known. It had been known to the Beatles because he'd been on Oh Boy, the TV show. And he was like, and not only was he on Oh Boy, he was like a big feature because he was a guitar player. And I've got like a clipping from Disc magazine from February 59, where the headline is, Tony makes me break my rule. A number of new faces have been and will be appearing in Oh Boy. And he goes, blah, blah, blah. His name is Tony Sheridan, the first artiste allowed to sing on the show carrying a guitar. Reason? This boy can really play it. And how? So that's so that's Jack Good writing in Disc magazine. And so he gets up there, and he is an amazing guitar player. And really the Beatles must have learned so much from him.
Well, he almost ended up in the Shadows.
Yeah, that would have been a bit of a different experience for Cliff, I imagine. I don't know that they would have had quite the sort of working relationship if Tony Sheridan was going up against Cliff Richard.
There are some, as we've said before, there are some videos and interviews with him. He does come across as quite a forceful character. Yeah. And I know he was known for berating the Beatles on stage, and he'd shout at them for playing too fast or playing in the wrong key. Apparently one gig he leapt off stage and punched someone in the face who was talking to his girlfriend.
Yeah,
but he, I don't know if you know the story about he was always talking about fights, and apparently John goaded him one time into fighting Pete Best.
Yeah, he's obviously someone that, because he's born in 1940, so he's only a few months older than John, isn't he? So although it feels a bit like, because he's the star, he must be older than them, but he's not that much older than them. But he's clearly the guy that hangs around and has only a few topics of conversation. If it's guitars, it's all right. George would be interested to talk to him. But a lot of the time he's like, oh, I'm brilliant at fighting me. I'm amazing. I can do judo and everything. And they're like, Pete did boxing. So let's see if we can't get them to wallop each other a bit.
But there's still some contention over who actually won that fight. they both say they won. We'll never know.
I think Pete wins by default now.
Yeah. Bert Kampfert, at the time, was only 37. And as you say, he was huge. He had his own orchestra. He'd had a US number one with Wonderland by Night. But crucially, yeah, he was a record producer.
Yeah, it's always interesting to think, because my impression from things like The Complete Beatles and reading books and things like that was that the Hamburg clubs were really, really grotty. But actually, they were proper organisations, at least top 10 sort of thing. And so perhaps it isn't a surprise that he got encouraged down there to listen to live music. especially as, you know, in the period where it was, keeping an eye out for this sort of burgeoning beat music that was coming through. But it is weird to think of when you get the stories of how much fighting and drinking and drugs and swearing and toilet seats around necks and all that sort of stuff and potentially urinating on people type stuff is happening, that someone like Burt Camfort, number one in America, would be going down the steps into that sort of seedy scene and going, oh yeah, well, let's sign them.
Yeah. So, yeah, the actual contract itself, there is some, well, disputes, possibly. I'll just read a bit. There's an article by Thorsten Nublauch, I think I pronounced that right, and it's a new document that has recently been found that provides new information about the Beatles' early days in Hamburg.
Ooh.
Mark Lewison sent the author of the article a copy of the document, which is an artist receipt, which each Beatle and an unknown Deutsche Grammophon executive signed. That's the Polydor's owners. The document shows that the Beatles were paid for recording 5 songs in Hamburg in 1961 with Tony Sheridan without receiving any formal rights. This contradicts the belief that the band had a recording contract with Burt Camfort for the My Bonnie sessions, as most books claimed. The document also reveals that the Beatles were regarded and paid as session musicians. The amount of money they received for the recordings, 175 Deutschmarks in total per person, was previously unknown, and only 5 songs were mentioned in the document, not 7 as previously thought. The other 2 songs, Nobody's Child and Take Out Some Insurance on Me, were not mentioned. The article provides more information on the background of the recordings, such as the Polydor documents for My Bonnie, The Saints, Why and Cry for a Shadow that were logged in 1961, and that the Beatles had a real contract with Burt Camfort Productions effective from July 1st, 1961. The contract had a duration of a year and obligated the Beatles to record at least 4 tracks for Burt Camfort on their own. So the songs recorded with Tony Sheridan in June, or at least the 2 recorded on their own during that session, were not counted in this contract.
I suspect they didn't have a clue what was going on, because they had sort of functional German, but they certainly didn't have contractual German. So they sign all this stuff, and they don't know what it is, really. And what's interesting is, had Burt Camfort been bothered, he could have really scuppered their future career. He could have held them to contract, and he could have made more of a play of putting their stuff out against their early stuff, maybe, even if they had got their EMI contract sorted. But luckily, because of the way this all plays out, everything sort of just falls apart a bit, and he's like, well, I'll release them, you know, a year later from the first session anyway. But he could have been a git about it, and he could have put his foot down and said, no, I've got a contract with you, and I've probably got an option to renew in there as well. And then it would have been insane. But luckily, I think the gentlemen of the industry, being people like Burt Camfort, talking to another gentleman like Brian Epstein,
yes,
they got to an agreement in the end, because these silly teenagers had signed something that they didn't understand.
Yeah. So with all that in mind, let's go to the first recording session, which took place on Thursday the 22nd, Friday the 23rd of June 1961 at the Friedrich Ebert Hall. I can't pronounce hardly any of this. Let's just say Hamburg.
Yeah.
Produced by Burt Camfort, engineer Karl Heinz, possibly sound technician was Gunther Sorensen. There were 2 mics recorded live on a 2-track tape recorder, and Pete Best described the studio, well, I say studio, as an unexciting school gym with a massive stage and lots of drapes.
Yeah, so for all we look back on these as like the Beatles' first professional recordings, and they were, it was very ad hoc. It was a school hall with a couple of mics. I think actually, amazingly though, they get a brilliant sound out for these.
Oh, they really do.
Yeah, because even on these original editions of these recordings as they come out on like the Beatles first, it sounds absolutely fab. There is obviously an issue in terms of the tonal mix because of stuff to do with which bits of the drum kit Pete was allowed to play. But and so it's not sort of full, it's not a full reflection, I don't think, of what the Beatles would have sounded like in the clubs, but it sound, I mean, quality-wise, for that situation, it's really good.
It's like when you hear those old, I think, was it Maximum R&B, the Who box set, and there was a dispute with Shel Talmy over the early tracks off My Generation, which sound really sort of muffled and mono. But you've got recordings of the high numbers before that, that the same as this, they're just such good quality. They sound like they were recorded yesterday, and as do these.
Yeah, it's a funny thing how crisp it is, and issued in stereo quite early on as well. So they've always had a particular sound to them when you hear them, but not the stereo that we associate with the Beatles recordings of everything on one side. It's actually quite a nice dynamic sound that you get to really hear everything. And what you get to hear more than anything is Paul McCartney's bass playing, which is just a treat, because he's barely a bass player at this point, yet he's already brilliant. So
you touched on it there, Pete's bass drum, or lack thereof.
Yeah, so this is the weird thing, and bless Pete for his importance in this, because in the clubs and the Cavern, places like that, he was famed for his like stomp, wasn't he? It's like the four to the floor. He wasn't doing anything clever with the kick drum, he was just going dump 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 dump. But that was, and they called it the atom beat.
Yes.
Imagine being a sort of drummer where you've got your own nickname for one of your drum things. But yeah, so his four to the floor thing, dum 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 dum, which would have been the driving force of their club stuff, whether it went too fast, too slow, sped up, slowed down, all that stuff, which was the problem. Camfort says, right, well, we're not having you thinking about anything other than your snare drum and your hi-hat and perhaps one cymbal. So get rid of your kick drum. So that's the low end of the drum kit gone already. The driving force, the dum dum dum, is gone. And he's apparently gets rid of the tom-toms as well. And so you don't hear any tom-toms on these recordings, except on Cry for a Shadow, which is something that no one ever mentions now we know that his drum kit was stripped down. But there is a floor tom on Cry for a Shadow, so there.
Yeah. But yeah, that atom beat, as it was called, which I love, is basically modern dance music.
Yeah, it is.
So,
yeah.
So at the clubs, all the other drummers would have been doing the standards, but all your jets go, must have sounded fantastic in the clubs.
If you were walking past the Cavern and it was drifting up the stairs, you know, the sound of that and people stomping along as well, you know, it would have been quite something to behold, I'm sure.
So should we start with My Bonnie?
Obviously, the first thing you're going to do if you're going to try and make your first record and put out a single is to go to a Scottish folk song. You know, that's the thing. It's, so something that is already 200 years old, probably first written down in the 19th century and then sort of starts to be recorded by folks, including a few sort of popular artists. But it's bonkers. Although on this LP, the important thing to remember is it doesn't have the slow intro on this record. So if you hear the single version of this, you've got the My Bonnie Lies Over, you know, or if the German version has a German language one as well tagged onto it. But it's not on this. It just goes straight into the dun 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 dun. And you're right into sort of beat slash twist territory straight away. But for a Scottish folk song about missing someone who's overseas,
it's one of the best.
Yeah.
But it's rumored to be a tribute to Bonnie Prince Charlie. It goes way back. George is doing lead guitar, although apparently Tony Sheridan played the solo, which was edited from a different thing. And yeah, there's two introductions. The German one, translated by Bernd Bertie, but it was released as a single and it made number 5 with Tony Sheridan and the Beat Brothers. I think we need to talk about the Beat Brothers.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the single that is really important in the Beatles story, because it is apparently the one that enough of a head of steam built up on their return from Hamburg that people were asking for this, because they were going around going, we made a record. I mean, depending on what you read, which paragraph you read in which book, they either loved it or hated it, you know, with these recordings. But they were obviously proud enough to sort of go, we made a record. I mean, look at this. You didn't make a record. We made a record. And my band put an album out last year, and I understand it, that when you're physically holding those things, it's like nothing else. It's absolutely brilliant. But for back then, they must have been amazed by it. Yeah, number 5 in Germany, though. But they're the Beat Brothers. They're not the Beatles, because of rudeness.
Yes. Care to elaborate?
I mean, so the story is, of course, and loads of people will know it, that Beatles apparently sounded too much like Beatles, which is German, low German slang for nether regions of the male variety.
Yeah. The Netherlands.
Yes, low countries. So they become the Beat Brothers. But that was what Tony Sheridan used for all, like his catch-all term, wasn't it? So
yeah,
for all the different recordings he made for a little while he's trying to get his European Twist career up and running.
Yeah. They used to have a Twist chart, didn't they, on its own. I think he made number 4 with this in the Twist-only genre chart.
That's very short-lived, I imagine. Very specific chart, that, isn't it? Yeah, it does get, obviously, when the Beatles' career takes off in 63, it gets into the charts in the UK for 1 week to the dizzying heights of number 48. But gets to number 26 in the Billboard Hot 100 the following year, like 1964. Mm. So people were clamouring so much for Beatles stuff. Yum, 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 yum. Eat it all up. And that's why this gets into charts beyond where it was supposed to get into the charts, which was Germany.
The exciting thing about this for me is really the backing, the whoops. That is what drives this song more than perhaps Tony's performance.
Yeah, one of my favourite things in many, many Beatles stuff, and it's writ large across certainly a couple of these ones, is the sound of Paul McCartney going woo in the background of things, or doing his sort of yells as the sections change and things like that, is just so absolutely commitment to what you're doing and excitement and the energy that it's like it can't be contained in the music. It's sort of coming out of his mouth whether it means it to or not. You know, this isn't even the Little Richard woos. This is just pure rock and roll whooping. Just, yeah. It's a great performance, I think, in general for this. And Paul's bass is brilliant. But this is one where Tony Sheridan says, I taught Paul how to, when he should change on the bass a little bit. So he does a lot of this is walking bass. Dum, 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 dum. But then in the sort of second sections, it's... And maybe, yeah, I suspect Sheridan's experience would probably be like, just change it up a little bit as the sections change. But Paul takes a lesson like that and runs with it, and he just shouldn't be as good on bass at this point as he is. And I think he's had his Hofner violin bass for like something like 2 weeks or something at this point, and he's already like, oh, I'm the bass player now. That wasn't supposed to happen, but he's doing it brilliantly.
And playing without a bass drum to
lock into, yeah. It's mad. But the guitar solo by Tony Sheridan, the overdub of that, or however they recorded that, is a good example of how good a guitarist Tony Sheridan is. Because George is doing all the little licks around it, on the other bits of it. But when Tony's in, it's like modern rock guitar playing.
It really is. Yeah, he's an astonishing guitar player.
Yeah. Yeah, I found a few little clippings about this in the various newspapers and things like that. And Tony Sheridan and the Beatles, this is from Disc again. I'm very lucky that I've got the archive of Disc through my library I can access. January 13th, 1962. Tony Sheridan and the Beatles, My Bonnie backed with the Saints, Polydor, and they give it 3 stars. And it's a very short thing, but it's interesting. It says, Tony Sheridan is a Norwich boy who sings and plays a guitar, which is such a... da-da-da. I mean, this is Disc magazine. People understand this stuff. He's been going great guns, I'm told, in Germany. Now, the German label Polydor puts him on Disc with the British rock instrumental group The Beatles. Both sides are good old standbys, and that's all it says.
That's it.
But I like it does say rock instrumental group, which is interesting because it's the word rock is writ large in that little bit there. But they're obviously not really an instrumental group. The irony is we know that they are a fantastic vocal group, but here they're being characterised like that, but rock, not rock and roll, not Twist, not anything, it's rock instrumental group from 1962. Oh, will the wind of the saints go marching in when the saints go marching in? I'm gonna be in the number. Ooh, when the old saints go marching.
Next we have the Saints, When the Saints Go Marching In.
Another weird choice. I mean, it sort of makes sense to do two traditionals sort of coupled together in the rocked up format. Things that they would have been doing in the clubs as well, or could have worked up in the clubs, and things that everyone would know. So apparently the My Bonnie, and it was well known because German school children had learned it, so it was familiar to everyone. The thing with their arrangement of the Saints, which... apparently Bill Haley and the Comets had a hit with as well, in the 50s. Another traditional thing, it's sort of born out of half hymn, half gospel, you know, merging together to make that sort of famous way we think of it now.
Yes.
But yeah. My problem with this is Tony Sheridan's approach to the tune is very free, let's say.
It is.
But it's such a well-known tune, and he somehow he manages to avoid singing that tune at all.
He's clearly a huge Elvis fan.
Oh, yes.
And it does veer into Vic Reed's pop singer version of Elvis.
This one more than I think any of the rest of them, really. It's more or less incomprehensible in terms of what he's doing on this one. And it's only that you'd perhaps, this song is familiar, that you would have stand any chance of getting what he's going on about.
Yeah, I find it very difficult to get over that for much of the recordings it did. So it does help if you focus on the backing. Yeah. And again, it's such a tight band. Pete's been criticised a lot, but he's doing great here. He's keeping the tempo. I know that should be a standard for any drummer, but it's something that's been targeted against him many times.
Yeah, he does amazing snare drum work. When he's given the focus of, essentially, his snare is all he's got to play with, other than, I think, his hats and his cymbal. And he does, I mean, it seems like a very high tune snare, so it's got a real bounce to it as well. But it means he can do these really long rolls, sort of type fills. And he does them very, very crisply and very, very effectively through a lot of these. And that's to be commended, really. It's not a club snare where you would tune it low and sort of just whack it really hard. He does have this really good control over this funny little sort of high-pitched snare that he's got going on.
We have a composition by Tony Sheridan and Bill Crompton. Why?
Yes. Interesting that this is the only original by anyone on here, you know, as in terms of Tony Sheridan writing, because apparently Tony Sheridan was encouraging John and Paul to write and apparently wrote a song with Paul that I think he just described it as crap. It's like, I bet he wish he didn't now. But yeah, so this is something I found this out yesterday. I was just tickling up my notes. And so, who is this Bill Crompton? So I had a look. And as far as I can tell, right, he co-wrote the song House of Bamboo, which Andy Williams does. And it's quite good, and quite a few people might know that. But he certainly co-wrote a song for a band called The Bulldogs in 1964. And that song is called John, Paul, George and Ringo.
Oh.
And it is a song about do it in the style of John, Paul, George and Ringo. And it's essentially like a weird mashup of Please Please Me from Me to You, She Loves You on steroids, but about put the attitude that the Beatles put into something. And the actual chorus is like John, Paul, George and Ringo would. And it's got all the woos in it, and it's got the yeah, yeah, yeahs. And it is one of those brilliant novelty things but it's really quite well done. It's very entertaining.
Don't tell me you can't do it. Come on, make up your mind. There's really nothing to it. Come on, let's try it one more time. I said shake, I mean shake it. Ooh, like John, Paul, George and Ringo. Like John, Paul, George and Ringo.
Yeah, people should look that up, definitely. But anyway, he does write Why with Tony Sheridan, which is just a slowy, really. Bit of a looking backwardsy sort of sound rather than a looking forwardsy sort of sound. A doe-eyed Elvis sort of heartthrob stuff.
Yeah. The bass is interesting. Whether he told Paul to do it, but the chords change, but the bass just descends.
Yeah.
So rather than play the root note, the bass descends, which is quite interesting. But then that's all it seems to do that throughout the whole song. Nothing really happens. Yeah,
it's I can't imagine it would have been too difficult to learn, but there's not much to it, really. But that ends up as a single as well later on.
Yeah.
So obviously when the success of the Beatles happens, this gets put out in the States, I think only in the States probably, with Cry for a Shadow on the flip side, and does even better than before and gets to 88. So yes. At this point, nobody wanted the old stuff. They just wanted what was next from the Beatles, clearly. You know, the initial rush to get whatever was happening was out of the way because now Capitol were involved actually putting stuff out at this point. Yeah. So Polydor couldn't really stand against that. And Y, backed with Cry for a Shadow, got 88 in the charts in America. But, I mean, I haven't had a single out in America, well, so what am I going to do? You know?
You've got the doo-wop backing, John, yeah, Paul and George, and John's doing the real dum, 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 the real deep.
Yeah. I think John's voice, where it appears on these recordings, is interesting because it's clearly a voice that is well practiced from hours and hours and hours of both doing singing but also staying up late at strange times of the day and night and totally not looking after yourself. So it's probably his voice on these can go much lower than it normally would.
Yes.
Because his vocal cords are just probably like flapping bits of meat, just raw, just awful. But yeah, so he can get to do all the low harmony stuff.
And I think the Pirellis obviously add to that as well, which they were taking, well, like cornflakes at this, yeah, point. Tony's vocal on this, I think as the song goes on, he sounds more and more manic with the...
Why? Yes, it is certainly giving it the full performance, the heart-rending sort of stuff. Yeah, perhaps doesn't come across as well in this recording as it might have done in a more arranged setting, maybe.
Take out some insurance on me, baby. Take out some insurance on me, baby. Well, if you ever say goodbye, I'm gonna hold right over and die.
Next we have If You Love Me, Baby, Take Out Some Insurance on Me, Baby.
Okay, baby. Yeah, a cover of a Jimmy Reed song, which came out on VJ for fans of obscure labels associated with the Beatles. This is pretty much his Elvis impersonation to the max on this, yes, one. It's the most bluesy one they do, obviously from a sort of Jimmy Reed background. And it's got a brilliant guitar solo from Tony Sheridan in it, where he clearly cocks it up in the first sort of passage of the guitar solo. And Bert Camfort, yeah, says, no, leave it, it's just like jazz.
Yeah.
It's like, no, yeah, it's just wrong, but you can't just say a wrong note is jazz. That's not how it works. But yeah, I do like that sort of the way the sort of tune sort of bubbles up, like it's like coming up from a well.
So it was written by Charles Singleton, who famously co-wrote the lyrics for Strangers in the Night, which is lovely.
I think there's something in this where there's a line about being like a stump in a field, you can't get rid of him, which is an amazing sort of metaphor. like a knackered old tree trunk that you can't... That's what I'm like. Our relationship is founded on the idea that you can't dig me out of the ground.
Yeah. Well, it was different lyrics to the original, so I don't know if that was Tony that did that bit of poetry.
Yeah. Very poetic. He does also, I mean, it's an interesting one because he does, it strangely aggressively says some goddamned insurance on me, baby, at one point. And it's like it comes out of nowhere. It's just slightly more aggressive than the rest of the song. I mean, he sort of blasphemes, if you want to put it in those terms. And it's like, that feels really weirdly out of place. I mean, I have gone down fine in the club and no one noticed it, but the way he just sort of delivers it slightly harder than the rest of the song is a bit weird. Mm.
Maybe he saw someone speaking to his girlfriend during the
recording. Yeah. You'd have heard the recording of him just running off. Microphone
crashing
knocking
at
over. Yeah. Thump.
As I was slowly passing an orphan's home one day,
just a little while to watch the children play alone. A boy was standing, and when I asked him why, he turned with eyes it could not see, and he began to cry.
Next, a song first recorded by Hank Snow in 1949. The song was written by Cy Coben and Mel Forey. Cy Coben, as well as having the honour of having his song covered by the Beatles and later the Travelling Wilburys, is also notable for cover songs of his songs Don't Jump Off the Roof, Dad, by Tommy Cooper, as well as The Difference Between Us and Alien by Leonard Nimoy. It's Nobody's Child.
Now, I might sound very harsh and hard on this one, because I know when you listen to Nobody's Child, you're supposed to be weeping and going, this is so heartbreaking, but this is kind of the worst thing on the record. It's a very cynically sort of written song anyway, to pull on the heartstrings, about an abandoned blind orphan boy. But this version of it does not work at all. And apparently it's only Paul and Pete playing on it with Tony on this one, because it's really badly arranged. And the rest of the stuff seems pretty smart, but this is like, I've been banging on about how good a guitar player Tony Sheridan is, but on this is crap. His rhythm playing is just weird on this. But I will say one thing. He does an opening on it, which sounds like the opening of George's You Like Me Too Much from the Help album.
Yeah.
Years later, he's more or less stuck it on electric piano a few years later. It's almost exactly the same as the opening to this.
It is, yes.
So maybe that was stuck in his mind because he...
I doubt it.
Well, yeah. But, yeah, Nobody's Child, which, of course, famously was Ringo's, the young Ringo's party piece to sing to his family and upset them by... Because can you imagine a young Ringo with those big eyes singing, I know, but you'd be like, oh. I'd much rather a recording of that than this, because this is just incomprehensible again.
He's really going overboard with the Elvis voice here. And it's the way he pronounces the word just as jizz.
It's a tricky tune as well, because it makes him sound a bit like he's about to start yodeling, or he's going, no, it's like, oh, right, there we go. Get the Alpenhorns on the go.
Oh, that would have been much better.
Yeah, it's a tricky, I mean, even like that Travelling Wilburys version's not brilliant. It's a hard song to sell, I think, this one, and probably would be better left to the cowboy swing singers, I think.
Julia Baird was on recently, and she was saying that John, this used to be his song when he was a kid. It's quite moving on that side. Really only on the chorus, I think. But she's still got those lyrics. She's written them out herself and just keeps them by computer just to remind what he was thinking. Yeah. And what I hate about that is that, you know, we were talking about his child, and she was saying, like, the true story of what happened. From his perspective, at the time, he wouldn't have known. He wouldn't have known that his mum loved him and did want him. He was being told something different, so that makes it all the more heartbreaking that he felt that way. I'm sure he knew, because obviously Julia got in touch with him later in his life, but for much of it he would have, certainly when he was recording Plastic Ono Band, the lyrics of Mother, she doesn't want him in that version.
Yeah,
so most of his life he grew up thinking that, and that's, as a piece of music, the chorus is, I think, really touching for me on that. But this song is just destroys it.
It does, yeah, it does. And yeah, it's very sad if you put it into context. I mean, or a context like that, because it's very hard when you're in your little to really understand what's going on. And he had so much going on around him, and yeah, I remember listening to Julia talking about that. So yeah, I'm sure this is for a lot of people, very, very emotional song, and as it was for Ringo, as it was for John and co. But yeah, like, by the time it gets to Tony Sheridan doing it in this session, it's got no emotional resonance whatsoever.
Oh, ain't she sweet? I see you walking down that street. Yes, I ask you very confidently. Ain't she sweet?
So, additional songs were recorded, which are far more interesting, including Ain't She Sweet.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting about this version of Ain't She Sweet, which is great, is where they got their arrangement from for this, because people keep talking about this being like Gene Vincent, because he did a version of it, but his version's nothing like this whatsoever. So I'm wondering if they sort of got into the clubs, started playing it a bit like Gene Vincent, but then the sort of the Max Schau of Hamburg forced them to sort of rock it up and rock it up and rock it up until it becomes this thing with Lennon's, like we've talked about, Lennon's raw voice coming across. He doesn't really sound like any other Lennon that we know over the years, but I think it's brilliant. I love listening to this because this is more the Beatles as the Beatles, more reflective of them, of the period. But again, it's an old song. It's 1927. You know, this is not, yeah, it's not one of their originals, of which they probably had, I think they only had a handful at the time that they would have potentially done. But it works, and obviously sticks in their mind because they go back and play it in the Get Back sessions, don't they, as well? And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and as well as Get Back, there's also, they did it during the Abbey Road sessions. There's a snippet of them doing it there.
Oh, yeah.
And also during Walls and Bridges, he's doing it there because he's singing that line, hydrophilicky.
Oh, yeah.
Which he goes back to again. Yeah. But yeah, you're absolutely right about, because in 1975, John said about Gene Vincent's version, he said it was very mellow and very high-pitched, and I used to do it just like that. But they said, harder. You know, Germans all want a bit more, like a march. So he ended up doing a harder version of it. And yeah, you can imagine the, yeah, come on, get into it. And that's what we're hearing there. And his voice, as you say, that bit at the beginning, oh, ain't she sweet?
Yeah.
There's no other Lennon vocal like it.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been weird, though, to come away from these sessions thinking, well, we've recorded some of our own stuff, and it to be Ain't She Sweet. Because they were rock and rollers through and through at this point, and they must have, even if it wasn't one of their own originals, they had so much more stuff that would have been them. But they choose this, and that's what makes it fascinating for, because it's not just a Chuck Berry, or it's not just an Elvis. It's Ain't She Sweet done in the Beatles Hamburg arrangement. And
yeah.
And that makes it really interesting and unique and quite special.
Because I think they played a few songs to Bert and he said, no, we don't want things like Love of the Loved or something like that, yeah, some of their own compositions. And he wanted this. But I'm wondering if they chose this exactly for what you were saying. Perhaps it was such a good live belter. That one always goes down well live.
Yeah. Well, it's clearly popular, like Gene Vincent doing it anyway, like I say, and then Duffy Power and people like that. So it's amazing how sort of rock and roll, which we think of eventually as being a singer-songwriter thing from essentially this point onwards, look, we've got a whole bunch of stuff here that's looking right back into, you know, the 20s and beyond for content. Yeah. You know, not even like early 50s stuff. It's like, let's find something else and make it our own.
Well, I suppose it's like Britpop looking back to the 60s.
Yeah.
Well, no, the timing doesn't work, but...
No, but you know what I mean. Either way, we feel old when you start thinking about that. So
let's move on quickly. Another thing about this, because George Harrison later said that the group, or at least he, misunderstood the purpose of these recordings and didn't realise they were merely going to be a backing band for Tony Sheridan. And he said it was all a bit disappointing because we'd been hoping to get a record contract. So, yeah, they must have really pushed Bert Kampfer to do their own songs.
And then they choose this, which, they must have felt this could have helped sell them. You know, if you want to advertise yourself, you pick your best material. And they chose Ain't She Sweet. So, like I say, it's brilliant and a lot of fun, but would it have been the thing that would have got you a record contract? I don't think so, probably. I don't know, maybe the Prelude Inn was talking when they decided this. Which one are we going to do? Let's do that one. Da, 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 da.
Then a song originally called Beetle Bop, it's Cry for a Shadow.
Beetle Bop. I love it's. They should have stuck with that title, except that they weren't the Beatles, they were the Beat Brothers. So they'd have had to call it the Beat Brother Bop.
Yes.
And that would have been weird. but instead they make it into a joke name so they can take the Mickey out of the shadows a bit. Anyway, I would say out of everything on this LP and these bunch of recordings, this is my absolute favourite. And this is a sort of thing that if you discovered this like on a... If this was the only thing that existed of the Beatles and you found it like on a garage band compilation type thing, you'd be like, this is amazing. This is nuts. Why haven't they got a bass drum on it? It's ludicrous. But it's... This is my... This Paul screaming woo on this one is definitely one of my all-time favourite Beatle moments. The way he does it in the background here. Because there's no vocals, so he's just... His voice is just being captured on the room mics for everything else. It's amazing. It's just like, oh, the energy. And I love the fact that this is born out of them taking the Mickey out of Rory Storm a little bit, apparently, because they're trying to learn Man of Mystery and getting Rory Storm to sing it to them, and he can't remember it, and, you know, he had a stammer, and he starts to sort of get a bit confused, and so they just start taking the Mickey a bit and playing their own version, putting him off, and end up writing this amazing tune instead. So, oh, keep it, do it.
Again, it's a couple of different versions of that, because George Harrison said, in Hamburg, we had to play so long, we actually used to play Apache, but John and I were just bullshitting one day, and he had this new little Rickenbacker with a funny kind of wobble bar on it. And he started playing that. I just came in, and we made it right up on the spot. The result wasn't a bit like Apache, but we liked it, and we used it in the act for a while. It's the first original composition to be professionally recorded. It wasn't a Lennon-McCartney. It was a Lennon-Harrison song. And I think it's George came up with the solo. He's got a songwriting credit on it. Yeah. But then I suppose there's no melody, so yeah, why not?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant demonstration of the weird sort of discipline they needed as a band at the time. Because instrumental stuff is a pain, because you have to learn it. And you can get away in rock and roll with a lot of, like, I know my blues scales. I know where to put my hand. We're in A, are we? All right, we can play anything. But if you're doing instrumental stuff... like Apache. Yeah, Apache you can learn from a record, fine. If you're writing it yourself, you have to remember it. And that's the thing. And yet, they write it and they clearly remember it. And George's playing on this is fab. You know, really, really good. Better than I think it is on the rest of the record, really. They clearly have much more ownership over it. Yeah, it's also good because, yeah, like you say, it starts out as a sort of Shadows parody, pastiche, whatever you want to call it. But it's being forged in the fires of Hamburg rather than in a nice posh studio like the Shadows were doing their stuff. You know, the Shadows have spent a lot of money on equipment. Oh, you've got the first Stratocaster outside of America or whatever. Whereas here, it's like, oh, we've got our guitars. We've got some amps that this German producer's brought for us. We're in a school hall. We've played it a few times down the club. This just doesn't make sense. Do it. It's fantastic.
Got to mention John's rhythm on this as well, which I think is one of the best things he's ever done. And that little intro that he does.
Yeah, I love it.
So not of its time.
Yeah, it's well arranged. That's the thing as well. You know, they have the good breaks in it. They have the sections like nicely delineated, which is why I was talking earlier about the floor tom. So we keep going on about Pete not having his drum kit fully assembled. Definitely there's a floor tom, because in the sort of B section, suddenly you get that real rumble. That's the closest you get to that, what I think would be their sound, is when...
Yeah.
So I assume they let him have the floor tom so he could play it, or potentially someone else played it alongside at those points. You know, you just don't know, given the bizarreness of stripping out the drum kit, but they have that arrangement of it here. And like those little chingy bits, chingy chords that John does are just great. This is what you want for your early Beatles. And imagine if this had been the only evidence of them writing an original. Imagine if everything had just gone wrong, as it so easily could have done. And this was the only thing that was an original Beatles number that was on record. Beyond, in spite of all the danger, which no one would have known.
Well, let me tell you, well, no chick mate could be the same as sweet George Brown. Crazy feet that dance and eat has sweet Georgia Brown. Fellas sigh and even cry for sweet Georgia Brown. I'll tell you just why. You know I don't lie. Oh.
So then we skip forward to Thursday the 24th of May 1962.
Yes.
And now we're at the Studio Rahlstedt M1 building, Raulo 128, Hamburg. Producer Bert Kampfert. Sound engineer Hans Falkenberg, sound technician Jürgen Kramer, and featuring Roy Young on piano, on the Thursday they record the backing tracks, and on the Friday they record the vocals. But Swanee River, which we'll never hear, and Sweet Georgia Brown.
Yeah, Sweet Georgia Brown. No basketball involved here, which is where so many people will know this tune from, being Harlem Globetrotters theme. So this is the real curio on this because of the bizarre vocal to it, because it's the version that exists now is a redone vocal from 1964. So it references the Beatles, which is mad. So again, back to the 1920s for another song. And they do this funny little thing, but then, yeah, like, I mean, we could go into why they did this recording session at all in the first place. It's like, why? Because it might have just been to fulfill a contract and then let them free of it. Why couldn't they just let them free of it? I don't see what the advantage was for something they weren't ever going to put out. And, you know, one of, like you just said, Swanee River is lost. So they didn't even take enough care and attention to retain that. And Tony Sheridan had already recorded it anyway, another time elsewhere. But yeah, the real weird feature on Sweet Georgia Brown is that verse. In Liverpool, she even dared to criticise the Beatles' hair with their whole fan club standing there. I mean, Sweet Georgia Brown. And then his comedy interjections about the group sounding marvellous with a piano.
Yeah.
Not too commercial, boys, not too commercial.
I say this group is absolutely marvellous with a piano, don't you think so? Not too commercial, boys, not too commercial.
Tony Sheridan, he re-recorded this. Originally, he's still doing his Elvis voice. But obviously, yeah, with the newer version, he's referencing the Beatles and possibly cashing in on some of their success.
Do you think he's making fun of Brian Epstein a little bit when he does the not too commercial, boys, not too commercial? Is that who he's mocking up?
I thought it was George Martin.
But would he have known George Martin to do that? That's what I wonder.
Well, he would have, yeah, when did he, off the Beatle track?
I mean, he might have.
He'd been doing interviews, and so he would have.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, that sort of makes sense. And the other thing I thought was, you know, because it's a sort of contractual thing, it's like, don't make it too commercial. We don't want to worry too much about it being any good.
But I think the addition of Roy Young on piano really does make a difference on this.
It really
does get going.
It is interesting to hear the Beatles with a piano played by someone else. Because Beatle piano is very Beatle piano. They have their own particular way of doing it because it's, you know, the songwriter aspect of playing the piano rather than having a performer piano player like Roy Young, which makes them sound more like Gerry and the Pacemakers, which obviously got a piano aspect to them as well. And Roy Young is really, really good on piano as well. And he's on a bunch of the other Tony Sheridan tracks playing organ. And he's, you know, astonishing on that. But he seemed like an interesting character, Roy Young. Another one from the sort of club band days with Tony Sheridan. But another guy who's perhaps misunderstood some of what happened to him in relation to the Beatles and thought he was asked to join the band, apparently. And so, whereas I think Mark Lewis sort of suggests, well, actually, Brian Epstein asked him to try and help him get them a record contract, and he misunderstood it as come back and join the Beatles and sort of carried on that story through the rest of his life. I'm sure not cynically, but sort of one of those misunderstandings of I could have been a Beatle. Because even in, like, I was reading his obituary in, like, the Oxford Mail or something like that, and it just got his story totally wrong, and it was just... doesn't do him any favours, really, as well.
There's, with technology being what it is, people have removed Tony's vocals on this, and there's an instrumental version, which is just fantastic. The backing vocals on this are so exciting.
Nice arrangement.
Yeah, I think Paul was credited.
He was credited in the paperwork, but like never anywhere else, and I'm pretty sure for no financial remuneration whatsoever. But the sort of cockiness you must have had to say, well, we came up with the backing vocals, I sorted that out, can I be the musical arranger? I don't know what would have got to the point where his name would have been put down on paper. It seems very strange, but fair enough.
Yeah. But it's got such good dynamics. Really, really powerful performance, I think.
Yeah, well, we're a year on from those other songs we were talking about, and their ability as a vocal group, and to understand their phenomenal control of their voices as part of the band is clearly even stronger at this point. So they're really good at those sort of funny little... And even though it's just backing vocals, they've just got something going on that's very Beatle-y. Well done, them. They're so good.
So, Paul, the Tony Sheridan recordings have generally been discarded by most Beatles fans. What would you say to people who are considering investing in these recordings?
It's worth getting. I mean, it's all part of the story, isn't it? And it's nice to have things that help flesh out the story as much as anything else, because it's a bit like Samira, friend of this podcast, coming up with that stuff from Stowe School recently.
Yes.
And that's like another lovely bit of the picture. And hopefully we'll get to hear that, you know, in its entirety at some point. But this is a really important part of it because of its commercial birth of the Beatles, albeit in a strange, unexpected way, pre what we're used to, pre the established canon. But it has got some really good examples of beat music on there, even if it doesn't have any kick drum on it. And it's got that weird hangover legacy of like the 50s and Tony Sheridan being representative of a certain breed of British performer as well, helping them, sort of kicking them into their own careers forward. And you do get, what, how many tracks of the Beat Brothers, which isn't the Beatles, of, you know, Let's Dance and What Did I Say and Ruby Baby and Ya-Ya, which are fun. You know, that's, you know, it's fleshed out with those sorts of things as well. But the Beatles bits of it, and especially Cry for a Shadow being heard in the context of everything else, is worth it. And if you're going to get the 1967 one, because it's so funny to have a psychedelic cover but then have all this stuff on it. I was pondering the weirdness. Imagine you're going into the studio to record something for Sgt. Pepper, and you're Paul McCartney or whoever, and a fan's waiting for you, and they come up to you with an album and it's this one and say, "Can you sign me record?" Do you think that ever happened? It's like, do you think they just go, "Nah, get off"? That's so do you reckon there's any signed copies of the Beatles First out there?
Oh, that'd be worth a fortune.
Maybe those bonkers bit of merchandise. But yeah, it's interesting because, as well, they do fold the Hamburg thing into their own backstory quite early on in their own sort of... Because instantly they hit as a big band in 63. People want to know where they've come from. And they mention these recordings a few times, and they say, "We did this and it wasn't very good," and that and the other. But now we've got it. Well, even then you could get it from 1964, 1967. And it really is worth having as part of the picture. It's a very important bit of the Beatles jigsaw.
Paul Abbott, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Now, ain't she nice? I looked her over once or twice. Well, I ask you very hydrophobic-y, ain't she nice?